A lot of you know Professor Barber as a faculty member here at Concordia Seminary. He also has some other professional abilities and qualifications that I'd like to share with you before he begins his presentation. Dr. Barber, excuse me, Professor Barber, almost Dr. Barber as soon as the dissertation gets through, has a master's degree in counseling psychology, a master of divinity degree, and is presently completing his doctorate in marriage and family therapy at St. Louis University. He is assistant professor of practical theology and the coordinator of specialized testing and counseling services at Concordia Seminary, St. Louis. Professor Barber holds professional memberships in the American Association for Counseling Development, the American Mental Health Counselors Association, and is a licensed professional counselor. Professor Barber.
We have to do that for the tape. It's not that I'm just so humble or anything. I want to talk to you today about growing close under stress. It's an odd thing that we do. It's an odd thing. Is this still okay if I do that? It's an odd thing that we do. It's so solid. Because here we are, we're all grown up, and most people in this room are of average intelligence or above. But somewhere along the lines, we have learned that if you're going to resolve conflict, if you're going to discuss differences and to work on growing closer with one another, we either go in the bathroom and lock the door, we stomp out of our house and get in our car and drive away, or we just get real quiet. You know, and how we come to that conclusion, one would think, well, now how does that work? You know, since we are of about average intelligence or so, because that doesn't work. And it does, you don't have to look far or look long or hard to discover that that doesn't work. So we're going to talk today about how it does work. Growing close, being close, means in a therapy sense of having an intimate relationship. And intimacy in the therapy vernacular means being able to share pain. Okay, when you can share pain, you grow close. And from that, we develop some sexual relationships and we develop close personal friendships and those kinds of issues. But just from what we're going to talk about today, we're going to talk about being able to share pain with one another. We do some very odd things as well, because when we're under a lot of stress, we become very rigid. And we become very rigid in a very specific way. And the specific way that we become rigid is determined by our family of origin. And we're going to hear that word a lot in the next few minutes. But family of origin is our mom and dad and the family situation, whatever it was, where we grew up. Now, checking my notes here. Intimacy is growing, is being able to share pain. Stress is an internal response to an external threat. Okay, does that make sense? So we perceive something as being threatening, a car coming down the road, we step off the road. We perceive that as being a threat and we take some action. When we're under stress, we can do only one of two things. We can either flee from that stress or we can fight it. We hear that on all the commercials, and that's nothing new. If you watch Webster, you know, they talk about that kind of stuff. So that's not new. Just kidding, I'm sorry. Well, we're going... No, I didn't bring my train of thought. Nobody ever takes pictures of me, and that's kind of interesting. Well, someone does. No, I want to talk about your family. That's why I became a therapist, so that I never have to talk about my family. No, that's terrible. We deal with stress based on our family of origin. Now, some of you have discovered that the seminary can be a source of stress. It's true. It can be. Oh, thank you.
Give you a longer leash.
Thank you. The seminary can be a source of stress. Now, the way that works, on a stress scale, excuse me, I do great in the pulpit, you can imagine. On a stress scale, if you do something like die, that's a lot of stress if you're dying. About the next thing on the list is like moving. The next thing on the list is like changing careers. You know what I'm saying here? Okay, so if you come to seminary, you have had to move. You have, if you have children, you've had to put them into a different school system. You've had to worry about their participation and developing new friendships, the same as you. The seminary is probably, just because of, forget the academic stuff, just the fact that you have to move and you're changing careers is enough. So you move, 2 years later you move again, you're gone for a year, you move back, and then a year later you move away again. Now that is a lot of stress. Now when you add in the academic work that goes with this, some of you have experienced some additional stress. Some of you may not. Maybe you're dead. I don't know. But if you have, I'm sorry. Some are dead. Yeah, burned out totally. But when you have this experience, your relationship changes. This is perceived as an external threat. All right. Suddenly, all the rules are different. What was true before is no longer true. And what wasn't true before now is true. There's a lot of fear that one's life will always be this way. The husband will always be gone. He'll always be under a lot of stress. He'll always come home and be mad and try to kick the cat because you've already taught him he can't kick you anymore. And so you have to develop some new rules and roles and expectations. And that's what we're going to talk about first. When you come from a family, all families have to have a certain balance. If they don't have this balance, they can't function. Because every family has to have some means by which, when information comes in, some external threat, they have to be able to maneuver around so that they do not lose balance. That's why when you look into a family, if one person tends to be real demanding and real loud and boisterous, there's another person who tends to be very timid and meek and kind of quiet. Because if you have two people who are loud and demanding and boisterous, you cannot survive that way. That makes sense, right? But it goes deeper than that. We learn from our family of origin. You had a particular role in your family of origin that helped balance out that stress. When you left that family, you took that role with you. Now, it's interesting because the impact of that role that you've had, or a role that you may have adopted that you've seen some family member take on, if you're a female, probably your mother, a male, your father, you tend to hold on to that for dear life. And when we get under stress especially, we become so rigid that we believe that there is no alternative to what we're doing. People go in the bathroom and lock the door because they believe that that is going to help the situation the most. They don't do it simply to save themselves. You have to balance out the family. If you go into the bathroom and lock the door and there's no one pounding on the door begging you to come out, there's no reason to go in and lock the door to begin with. So we interact and interplay with each other in a very circular way. We do not have I want to erase this from your minds if I can. We do not have a cause where someone does something and then we have an effect where someone responds to that. If it were only that easy. We live in a world where we have what we call circular responses, circular communication patterns. So I say something because my wife, I'm responding to something my spouse did or said, and so I respond and then she responds to that, and it was probably based on something maybe back here, some other experience that she's had in her family of origin, so we kind of go round and round. The problem is that when you become rigid, your reality is your reality. There is nothing else. You can go to your neighbor and they'll say to you, "Well, have you ever tried doing this?" You all have had that experience, haven't you? And you say, yeah, what a jerk for suggesting something like that. Don't ask them if you don't want to know. They're a jerk for suggesting that only because it works for them. It may not work for you. Okay, that doesn't mean that they're a jerk. It simply means that it doesn't feel as though it would work for you. You have to do what you think is best. Now, people define relationships in certain ways. Before we get into that, let's talk about rules. Rules are given to you by your family. We are supposed to be a certain way, and that is an expectation. Your parents told you, some parents, some significant other told you that you were supposed to be a certain way. And it was probably implied more than explicit. Well, they probably told you 100 ways you were supposed to be, but certain things you're supposed to be. You're supposed to be a pastor, you're supposed to be a good woman, you know, you're supposed to be a forceful individual. You know, each person's family has given them different rules, a certain expectation. You take those expectations and you turn them into rules. So my expectation was always to be, I grew up with three sisters, my expectation was to be the man of the family. Okay, now my father died when I was very young, so here I'm growing up with three sisters, which is a nightmare, trust me. So I'm growing up with these three sisters, and I'm supposed to be the man of the family. But I'm the third down the list, so I got two older sisters. But if you're the man of the family, you're supposed to be able to rule them too, right? It doesn't work, but the expectation was there. I had to develop certain rules. One is that because of one of my family, the way my family presented this to me, one was that a male is supposed to be in charge. Oh, that's ugly, isn't it? But you meet my wife, you'll see how ugly my life can be sometimes. Because she's a take charge kind of person. She's an oldest child, and she's an executive type. But because of this rule, because of this expectation, I had to develop the rule that men are in charge. Okay? Now, when I have a rule like that, when that rule gets broken, I get real nervous and upset. Just like when your rules are broken. That is my reality. It used to be my reality. I can talk about it now because that's no longer my reality. And I'm just glad my wife isn't here to confirm that. I love my wife, and I don't want to, this is on tape, I love you, but and I don't want to give any other impression, but she is an oldest child, and she's an executive type, and sometimes she says please, and sometimes she doesn't, but we love and respect each other, and we've learned to define our relationship in such a way that we both add in enough said. Okay, the expectation is I'm in charge. If my, say my sister would come to me and say, I want to do this. No, because I want to do that. And it would be a conflict until I won, or until I moved heaven and earth to win. It wasn't because the activity was so important, it was the rule that was so important. If you have a rule about anger, for instance, your rule says that you are never to express anger verbally, openly, unless it just builds up and then you explode. If you explode, then that's okay, then that's the way you function. Okay, that's your rule. Because for me to say, well, I think you, every time you get angry, you should express that anger in a tactful way to the person with whom you're angry. Well, sure you should. Just like you should be rich and famous. But if the rule is not there, you cannot do it. You have to have the rule. That wasn't the expectation that you grew up with. The rule is that I hold it in. I stuff it. I'm a man. I stuff it until I explode. And when I explode, it's because I'm so darn angry, and it's your fault that I'm so darn angry. You shouldn't make me so darn angry, and I wouldn't have to explode. Well, that's nuts. You know, I'll tell you up front, that's nuts. But that's the expectation we have. So we have to develop a rule that we stuff our anger in some families. And so the role that I have to be is one who explodes. I have to become a dangerous person. Because people who explode are seen as dangerous people, are they not? It doesn't matter how kind and gentle they are, you know. Suddenly they start getting that tense look on their face, and it's like, oh no, it's coming. And you don't know when, but you start backing off. And that's really not conducive to a close, intimate type relationship, just as an example. So our families give us expectations. We take those expectations and they become our own. To be able to realize those expectations, we have to develop rules. The rules then tell us what kind of person we're going to be, the roles that we're going to develop. Now, you learn that in your family of origin. It's real strong. The secret about this is that once you know this, like once you've been here today, you're not stuck with that anymore. You can change it if you so desire. Now, most families, when they're under stress, Virginia Satir says this, God rest her soul. She's dead. Most people don't know that. Most people don't even know who the heck she is. So it's neither here nor there. But I've always liked her. Well, I need four volunteers. OK, Could I get 4 volunteers? Oh, Fred, Kent, and if I could, and one more female is what I need, is another female. Oh, great. This is great. The only people who don't know me that volunteer, and so I, no, I appreciate you doing this. Actually, you've probably seen this before. Virginia Satir says that people develop 4 different types of stances when they're under a lot of stress. You become either the blamer, you become, I'm sorry, I've set this up myself. You become either the blamer, the placator, the irrelevant one, or the computer type. And everyone will fall into one of those 4 categories, most likely. Now, you can switch around, but you'll switch from the blamer to the placator or something. We're going to talk about what that looks like in just a minute. But how about right now? Who's the blamer here? See that hand?
A blamer would be one that would point it at somebody.
Yeah,
But I'll happily do that.
Okay, we'll just pretend that Fred is the blamer. Now, a blamer is a person who feels very bad on the inside, but for some reason his rule has been, sorry, the rule that he has received is that if he is not in control, he is at least to look like he's in control. Okay? Okay, well, good. Good. But the only way that you can look like you're in control, if you're not in control, is to be usually angry, to blame. And the reason things are going this way is because, well, you messed up. So a blamer will point. Yeah, and get that look. Yeah, and they grind their teeth a little bit, too. So if you would point, if you put your arm out like this, and get that elbow, because you're ticked, and that back straight, man, nobody could be more in charge than this man. Although on the inside, he doesn't feel in control, he feels kind of lost, and somewhat helpless. Okay, now that's the part I want to focus on. Because when you have somebody pointing your finger at you emotionally, they're not having a very good time. Now if your father did this, true? When your father did this to you, or your mother did this to you, it did not feel good. Okay, typically, how's your arm feeling?
It's good.
Oh, good. Oh, good. Well, wait, and
right is anger.
Okay. Now, okay, for this to work, before you can have a blamer, you have to have a placator, right? Who wants to be a placator? Female. Who is our other female here? Oh, okay. Would you come here just a moment, please? Now, a placator is someone who sort of diffuses the anger, because if they point fingers at each other like we talked about a moment ago, things just blow up. It won't work. The family, the relationship cannot survive if they decide to point at each other. It just can't. Do we understand why that is? Okay, so if you would point, now the placator has to come, if you would get down on one knee here before your, and just be as humble as possible.
To realize if this is Tom, I would not be doing this.
Yeah. We understand this, right? Okay, this, you're playing along, and this, let's do this. Why don't you be the blamer?
All right, I can live with that.
Okay, she's more comfortable being the blamer. Okay, so would you be the placator? Okay. Okay, now you have to put your arms straight out. Okay, back straight and the feet together. Okay, and if you put one hand on the floor, your palm flat on the floor, and look up right in her eye because she demands good eye contact. Now, this is what a blamer and a placator look like.
Don't get the idea.
Have you seen this in your family? Have you seen where someone is blaming and the other person has to placate? Okay, most people have seen something like this in their family. It's on some level. But then, see, this gets too intense. Because how's your arm doing?
It's cool.
It's cool. Okay. How's your neck?
It's great.
It's great. Good. They love this. Okay, if I could get you.
I can do
that. Let's see. What is your name, Bob?
Bev.
Bev, thank you for your help. And you?
Chris.
Thank you for your help. Now, Chris is going to be the computer person because these are her parents, and she just can't stand what's going on. The pain is really too intense. So, and besides, if she got involved, what would happen?
She
you'd blame me.
Yeah, no feeling. Yeah, yeah. You might get sucked into a... Oh, how's your arm doing?
Fine.
Your arm's getting tired. How's your neck?
Fine.
Oh, good. Because most people, their neck gets real tired, and their shoulders start to hurt like yours probably will in a few minutes. Well, no. No, I'm very uncomfortable. How does it make you feel to see this?
Me and me here, everybody loves that.
Now, does this feel right to you?
No.
No, it doesn't feel good. How does this make you feel?
No, I'm not enjoying it particularly.
Okay, but inside, what's it like to have a finger pointed at you?
It's not real nice.
It's not real nice. No, it's not. And how do you feel pointing your finger, Fred?
Ultimately or at this moment?
Maybe you'd want to join me down here.
Let's say right now, what's it feel like to have to blame and point?
Well, it doesn't feel very good, but most people who are in this position or feel the need to point a finger at somebody, it's their only escape, and they don't really realize the conflict it's creating until afterwards. And then you have another conflict to deal with. Well, you know, if you didn't make me point my finger at you, I wouldn't have pointed my finger at you.
Amen.
It's a vicious circle.
Amen. Okay. But you're as humble as possible. As humble as possible. Now, one thing with spouse abuse, I'll just throw this in free. One thing with spouse abuse is that what triggers a male abuser, and they tend to be more male than female, what triggers the male abuser has nothing to do with what's going on in the relationship. Okay, it's an internal trigger that goes off, and no matter how humble, because the closer you get to this attack that's coming, the more humble the spouse becomes. It's whatever you want, I will do, I'll be happy to do. But the more humble they become, the angrier the male becomes, because the two are not correlated, there's something else going on. I'll just throw that in. Okay, so we have, and it doesn't feel good, it doesn't feel good. And so if you would turn this way, you're the daughter, if you turn totally away from them, so you're, as far as you're concerned, you're not a part of this family. Mm-hmm. The computer, what the computer does is they figure all this stuff out right up here intellectually. Okay, it's important to them. They probably do pretty well at school. They don't deal with any part of this. The heart is just something that they have to stay away from because the pain is so intense. The computer is feeling the pain from the whole family. Now, the computer may look aloof and apart from this, but the computer says things like, oh, one should never be involved in parental fights. Okay? They use non-personal type pronouns, those kinds of things. And then we have the irrelevant one. Now, who else? Oh, okay, here's the irrelevant one. And Kent knows what I'm talking about because he's out of my class. But Kent, the irrelevant one is the one who has to have a glass of water now. The one who has to go to the bathroom instantly, you know. The one where you're right in the midst of the heat of battle and there suddenly he punches sister. You know, that is to defuse. That is... Oh, she almost came out of her computer roller. That is to defuse the intense anger because these people are interconnected by the heartstrings. Okay, in spite of what's going on up here, each one of them knows what's going on within their family, just like you know what's going on within your family, and you know the level of pain. The irrelevant one probably passes between them somehow or another, making certain demands, trying to create a diversion of some kind, and it is very hard work to look stupid in the middle of an activity like this. It is hard work. It is a gift. How are you feeling? Okay, why don't you stand up and thank you all very much. That was nice. Is that okay? Oh, sweet baby.
So dramatic.
So dramatic, yeah. Relationships tend to work in threes. Now, think about that. Think about the implications for you. Relationships tend to work in threes. You cannot have, you probably do not have a stable relationship without a third. That may be a child, maybe a dog, a cat, a boat. It may be God. I show this in my class. I personally think that is where that relationship, why it even works that way, why people work that way. Without a third in the relationship, relationships tend to be unstable. What we tend to do is when our relationship feels unstable, we tend to suck a child into it if we have children. If we don't, we tend to suck a neighbor into it. So we go to the neighbor and we say, you know, neighbor, I feel like my husband's a jerk and I just don't know what to do with him. And the neighbor will go, yeah, he probably is a jerk and I've seen him do this and that and agree. The issue is that the neighbor feels kind of honored to have that information shared with them. Is that not kind of the feeling? Sure it is. And the last thing you want to do is to turn that feeling off or turn that individual down. And so the only thing you can really do is agree with the individual. Or at the very best, you try to be more objective and just be a sounding board. And that's all good. I think that's called sharing one's burdens. I'm not saying that that's good or bad. I'm simply saying that we tend to operate in threes. Now, knowing that there are threes and knowing that there is probably a child sucked into this, what we have to do is fire the child from our own conflict. We have certain boundaries around our relationships. We have a husband-wife relationship. We have a mother-father relationship. And the mother and father are always in access or have access to the children. That's the way it has to be. If the father decides to cut off because he's too busy with his studies or he's just so important because he's a pastor or something like that, well, he's a jerk. You're a jerk, you know, and you're going to pay the very heavy price for that. But the point is that you have to have access to the children. The children have to have access to you, mother and father. But you have another relationship. You have husband and wife. Now, before we get too deeply into that, because that's really the crux of what we're doing here today, before we get too deeply into that, you also have another relationship, which is like Joe and Pam. That's my wife's name, by the way. If I can no longer be Joe, if I have to be pastor or professor, or if I have to be father, if I can no longer be Joe, I feel like there's something missing in my life. Because Joe is where I started out. Joe is where all of my rules and regulations come from my family of origin. It's okay to nurture Joe, and it's okay for me to be nurtured. You know, I like to go out and do things, go to a movie, I like to go on a hike or something, sometimes all by myself. And my family doesn't get offended, and I don't get offended when my wife has to go out and she wants to do something with the girls, where people call her Pam instead of Mom, you know, where she doesn't have to clean up milk that's been spilled on the restaurant table. It's just nice to get out and be Pam for a while. But it's also nice to be husband and wife for a while. That means exclusive of the children. It doesn't mean I no longer love my children. It simply means that I have a relationship that I have made a commitment to that I have to nurture for it to continue to grow. You cannot, well, Rose, my secretary, dear woman, she gives me these plants. I told her, I said, I would love to be able to grow plants. And she's quite a green thumb. Go in her office someday. It's just beautiful plants. So she gives me this stuff, and I kill it, and I take it back, and then she'll fix it and give it back to me with new instructions. And where is this leading? Oh, but I have not learned how to nurture this relationship. She gives me this great plant. God gave me a great wife. He did. And I am so blessed to have my wife. But sometimes I do things that are not nurturing. As a matter of fact, sometimes the things that I do are harmful to the relationship. Sometimes intentionally. It's not... Yes. Yes. It's not because I'm a total jerk. A little bit sometimes. It's not because I'm a total jerk, it's because I get confused when I'm nurturing Joe versus when I'm nurturing the relationship with my wife versus when I'm a mother and a father, or when I'm the father part of that relationship. But see, I'm also a son to my parents. And I was also at one time a brother, and we'll get into that sometime. But you are different roles to different people. What we're going to talk about today is that husband and wife. But you cannot, when one part of your relationship starts to go sour, Meaning when your mother and father relationship starts to go sour, the rest of it tends to begin to disintegrate. When your family, when you're a pastor, for instance, and your family is not going as you want it to go, when you do not feel fulfilled or feel like you're doing the best job that you can being a father and a husband, the ministry tends to begin to wobble. Now, we don't want it to be that way. And we should be able to just go in and just do church work full time and never come home, and everybody's just glad to see you when you finally do come in, and oh, thank heavens you're a minister and you're saving the world. It doesn't work that way at all. It only works that way in here. And it usually, the farther away you get from your family, the easier it is to rationalize those kinds of things. The less competent you feel as a father, the easier it is for you to rationalize that the kids are better off without you, basically. The less competent you feel as a minister, the easier it is to rationalize that you're far better off playing golf or not working on sermons or something of that nature. We tend to create distance. What we do with our husband and wife relationship is we have a certain amount of closeness and a certain amount of distance. And we all have certain ways that we create closeness or distance. I'm going to ask something real risky now. What are some ways that you create closeness? We'll do the less risky first. Anyone care to talk about the ways that they create closeness with their spouse? Strictly husband and wife, yes.
I buy my wife flowers for no reason.
And that's nice. And what's it like when you get those flowers?
Wonderful. And what's more exciting is you hear everybody go, oh.
Do you ever get too many flowers? Do you ever feel like? Do you ever get too many flowers? Like, okay, I didn't think so. Yeah.
It's even better when nobody else in the office thinks they're doing that for their wife.
Yes. Yes. And that. And the. Yes. How else do we gain closeness with our spouse? Yes.
Take a walk and talk.
Take a walk and talk. Just time. Time where you're just focused on each other. That's nice. Yes. Nice. Does that sound dumb? No.
I know it's so that he cares about sure. And he'll give the children their vitamins. It's almost like his duty for the day or something. But he knows that if he doesn't do that, I would forget about it and the children would probably die or something.
Sort of a mixture of law and gospel. Yeah. 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 Now, does that sound dumb?
Yeah.
Yeah, that just... No, it doesn't sound dumb. No. No, that's nice. That's nice. You put... But that's nice. You put toothpaste on each other's... Oh, yeah, who's married to who? No, that... But that's neat, yes. How many of you ask questions, then when you get the answer, are ticked off? Sure, most of us do that. Especially if our kids and our spouses, the people that we're the closest to. And why do we do that? We're of average intelligence. Because it was done to us and our family. Oh, I thought you had a question. Yes.
I know some guys are putting their arms around the wire, tugging.
Closeness in terms of physical touch. There are some families of origin. My family of origin is very distant from each other. We don't. I don't even know most of them until I did a genogram, a family tree type thing. I didn't know where they lived. I didn't know their names. It wasn't important. It wasn't any big deal. But my family, my wife's family, when the first time I went in, her sister kissed me. It's like, oh, my God. Did anybody see? She doesn't even know me. But they are kissers. They are kissers and huggers. They're very affectionate. I mean, it was just a tap. But still, it was the idea that to be that physically close to someone else who was not my spouse or girlfriend or something was made me very uptight. That's a rule that my family had. The expectation was you don't get close. Therefore, the rule has to be you certainly don't hug or kiss anyone. And the role is the one who kind of stands back during those activities and just kind of watches what goes on around you. What are the ways? Yeah.
I just want to ask a question, I guess. Is it possible to form rules that are in opposition to what went on in your family?
Yes.
Because I'm just thinking, I grew up in a family of origin that was not physically affectionate, and it's like I have a compulsion to be physically affectionate in my life. Is that also possible?
We tend to either go the way of our family or the exact opposite of our family. As a matter of fact, now every time I see my sister-in-law, no, I'm just joking. Just joking. The family promotes and gives permission for you to be a certain way. And if you go astray from that, then you are in essence disloyal to your family. And there is tremendous pressure once you have changed a rule. For instance, when my wife and I, she taught me to be close and to touch and to hug and to be able to feel free to do those kinds of things. And I'm eternally grateful to her for that. But when we go home to my house, the rule is that you just don't do that kind of thing. And it's just an unspoken thing. You go in, you know what it's like to be married, and you go home to your parents, and it's like, we really should be sleeping in a different bedroom. You know, that's a part of that pressure, even though everyone expects, you know, the family would say that you're kind of nuts if you sleep and they call a counselor or something. But the feeling is there. There is an intense pressure. When you change to go back to the old way, and it will happen in very subtle ways, especially when you do something that goes against a very open rule or one of the secrets that your family holds. A secret is a very powerful bit of knowledge that the whole family is aware of, but no one says anything about because they are afraid that someone might know about it, if that makes sense. So you do not disclose secrets, even though everyone knows about them. But not to disclose the secret means that it maintains its power, and the whole family revolves around the secret. You develop your relationships, the expectations that your family has, so you don't disclose the secret. Whatever you have to do not to disclose it, you do, even if that means divorcing, even if that means not being close to someone, no matter what, you don't disclose these secrets. And most families have some secret. You know, we talk about skeletons in the closet and that kind of thing. And when I started doing my family tree, it was real scary because I've been discovered why no one wanted me to know about my family. And I'm not going to discuss it here because it's on tape. You keep this role and these rules forever. It is very hard to take a rule and throw it out the window. The easiest way to do this is to change a rule. So for me, to be the rule, if your rule was never to get angry until you explode, if you can change it to, if you will express your anger like once a month, it's better than the explosion. Does that make sense? And then you can change that rule. That's why therapy sometimes takes a long time, because you're changing rules very slowly, whether you use the word rule or not. But you change the rule, and then you change it again, and change it again. And then when you go home, there's a process in family therapy where you do go home, because most of us end up going home at some point. And when you have that rule that's different, and it's changed, when you do go home, it's a very strange experience. It's a very confirming experience on the one hand, but there's a lot of pressure to go back to the old way. When you do not succumb to the pressure, you will know that what you have done is made yourselves more comfortable with your family. Your family begins to see you in a different way. Now, family is a lot like a cake. A cake has fire eggs and sugar and heaven knows what else, but it has that kind of stuff in it, right? So when you bake a cake, you can never take the flour and the eggs and the sugar back out. If you put in too many eggs, the whole cake is different. Too much flour, the whole cake is different. That is the heartstrings that interconnect between our families. That is that cake business. We end up with more than we actually start with. Two and two no longer makes four, it makes five. We have this other dimension. When we have God, who's a part of that cake, we have an even better dimension, if you will, and a more easily flexed dimension that allows us to be use things like forgiveness. Now, one family rule that almost every family has is forgiveness. There is probably one or two things within your family that you do not forgive. We know God says that the only unforgivable sin is unbelief, right? But your family says that there are other unforgivable sins. What are some of your unforgivable sins? Great. Yes. Lying. Yeah, dishonesty. Forget that. Yeah, you can do a lot of things, but lie in your family, that's it, huh? Okay, what else? That's true in our family as well, my family. Yeah.
Disloyalty.
Disloyalty. You're not disloyal to your parents, I take it.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that's a big one. Because if you're disloyal to your parents... Okay, we'll just go with that. Yes. Yeah.
Marrying the wrong spouse.
Ooh.
According to their expectations.
Okay, yeah. Their expectations are that you'll marry a certain type. The rule is that you have to look for that type, so the rule is that you're a husband to that type of individual. Yes. What are some other unforgivable sins in your family?
Just in ours, tampering with the other's cooking.
Ooh. Okay. But, okay, yes. Okay. Yeah, so I got several. Yeah, okay, so that's a confirming. That's right. How many people? Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. See, some families, you just, you ever see Fiddler on the Roof? Yeah. Okay, yeah, you just, it's like, hey, you're dead. I'm sorry, you know, I brought you into this world, and now you're dead. See, my wife was Roman Catholic. And they were Roman Catholic when they came off of Mayflower or wherever they came from. And when she, this was back in her secular, or you know, before the ministry was ever considered, when she went to tell her family that she was going to become a Lutheran, for heaven's sake, it was quite a stir, quite an ugly stir. It was one of those, oh, well, that's nice, you know. But when the doors closed, you hear pans rattling and stuff, and. They were polite about it, but it was a big deal. Our secrets tend to be the more impacted, the more emotionally impacted these rules are, the harder they are to break. So we develop closeness. That's how we got onto this, heaven knows. We develop closeness in certain ways. We do things for each other. We say things to each other. How do we create distance? And everyone has a technique by which they create distance. Because we can only stay in closeness for so long because we are a fallen race and we just can't handle it. How do we create distance? How do you create distance? Yes.
Not to be listening.
Yes. Not really listening. And we do it in such a way, we don't pretend like we're listening. You know, it's like we look at them, but our eyes are vacant. I mean, it's, you know that feeling. And it's like you have to work to get your eyes vacant. Do you not? Sure you do. Yes.
Silence.
Silence is a big one. Yeah. Yes. Yes, retreating behind the newspaper. Studies, homework. Yeah. Yeah, I got to put in 40 extra hours. Yes.
Sarcasm.
Oh, excuse me. Sarcasm, that's right. That's right. Sarcasm is one. Sarcasm is very cutting. You talk about constructive criticism, you know, we know that there's no such thing. A cut is a cut is a cut. You know, it feels bad. How do, in terms of your own relationship, when do you tend to develop more distance as opposed to more closeness?
More stress.
More stress. Yeah, things are tough. And are things tough at the seminary? Oh, good, we got one nay here and then 400 yeses. Yes, things are tough at the seminary. There is a lot of stress here at the seminary. So we go into this pattern that we have learned from our family of origin. Plus, if we have learned from our family of origin that we are only to be this close to someone, and if what's really scary, we tend, if I come from a family that says that you can only be this close to someone, we tend to marry someone who says you have to be this close. Is that not correct in your own relationship there? Let's think a minute. Okay, we get some yes nods here. Now the problem with that, you can sense some stress immediately when what happens is that suddenly this person has to be this close, you have to be this close. When you really and truly love someone, that means you're this close. When this person really loves, truly loves someone, they have to be this close. And it's a scary thing, because when the person once says you have to be this close, the other person starts backing away. And the other person starts trudging along. You know, it's like, well, why don't you love me anymore? Well, I do love you. I do love you. And there's conflict there. And both the messages are exactly the same. I love you. I want to be a part of this relationship. I'm glad to be a part of this relationship. I may have difficulty getting closer, but what is interesting, when this person finally gets sick of it and says, I'm not chasing you anymore, I'm getting out of this, they start going this way, and then what happens? Da-da-da-da-da, you know? Because there has to be a certain level where there is a comfort. When you can find that comfort level, it's much easier. Whether it's this close, is that? Am I echoing in here? Sorry. No, I'm sorry. I shouldn't be doing that, I guess. Whether it's this close or this close, whatever your comfort level is, that's fine. Because whether you like this or like this, God can still squeeze in there. Okay, it's not a question of Him, like, we tend to think of God putting little obstacles in our paths, and He doesn't do that. We know that He doesn't do that. God is always a part of our relationship, and He's always giving us what we need to be able to be close. Because in His eyes, we are one. He doesn't see us separate. Okay? But since we're fallen, it's real hard for us to understand that or to see that. So if we can find a comfort level, it becomes much easier. But how do we discover what the comfort level is? What would you guess? I'm sorry?
Trial and error.
Trial and error is one. But how do you know with the error part? You know, I mean... you get this close and they go this way and... How can we do that? Talk to each other and tell them. Amen. We're of average intelligence, are we not? How many of you are able to sit down and say, you know, hon, I feel like you want to be this close, and I want to be this close? How many people can do that? And why is it we can't do that? The other person takes offense. It's like, well, if you want to be here, that means you don't love me. Yeah. You know?
Well, part of it is because of that agreement with you. You're presuming you're right. When you start out in a prideful position that everything should be the way I want it. And if you're disagreeing with that, somehow you're saying I'm wrong.
Right. Yes.
You're also revealing one of the most closely held secrets of yourself, which opens you up to be hurt by rejection from that other person. And it's very, very difficult to do, to open yourself up to be hurt.
Amen. Amen to that. Yeah.
I think sometimes we really don't know how we want to fit into that relationship. We want to be close, but we don't know how to get there.
Joe, catch those comments?
Okay, yeah, we want to be close, but we don't know how to get there. Yeah.
On the other side of Joe's coin, sometimes the person who's here doesn't want to hurt the person whose feelings is here, you know, because they're going to think, well, you want to be here, so you don't love me, you know, because I want to be here. So that person who's here shuts up and doesn't want to hurt the other person's feelings, and then tries to get here, and that causes stress upon stress a lot of times.
Right. So then we have to start developing ways of creating distance. And when we start creating, we know when someone's developing distance with us. It's okay if they do it for a few minutes. You know, I want to go knock over a liquor store. Well, that's okay. Just be back, you know, by midnight or something. But we know that that's a temporary thing. When we start feeling it coming at a rapid pace and more distance is developed, it's a real scary thing. How many people in their heart of hearts would prefer to be here as opposed to here? Yeah, most people want to be here. And when they feel like they can't get any closer than here, they feel like something is wrong with them. How many people feel that something is wrong with you? Oh, I can't ask that. Oh, great, we got two or three honest ones. Okay. Most of us believe that if we can't get to here because we want to be there, then there's something the matter. Well, there are some things that matter. Probably it's the rules that we hold about closeness. And the rules we hold about trust, even amongst those with whom we are in the closest relationship possible. And it has to do with the rules we hold about disclosure and about vulnerability. When we are this far from someone, and we prefer to be this close, if you ask someone who's this far away, do you really and truly trust me? They will probably say no. If you say, do you really and truly love me? They will no doubtedly say yes. Where does it happen that trust and love are not synonymous? Are they synonymous in your life? You ever had a dog that you loved but bit you so you got rid of him? Perhaps not. But people are really, that's kind of a, but people aren't really that different. How many of you have been in a relationship that has gone close, and when you get to the point where you feel like you're like this, suddenly it begins to explode on you? You begin to feel some disintegration coming upon you. Sure, and it's that need to get further apart. But in the process of learning where this is, there is a lot of trust that is shot down. It's a crash and burn situation. You want to be here, you try to be here, you start getting hurt, and so you back off. And you learn just how close, most of us want to be just enough close in so that we can feel close, but close enough to the door at the same time where we can always hike it out if we need to. Is it not true? Sure, because we're human beings, and because we are a fallen people, and we trust upon our own instincts and our own relationships to develop this closeness. We do not see ourselves. It is far easier for some people, let me see how I can tactfully put this. There's no tactful way. Most of us see everyone else as being saved by Jesus Christ. Everyone else is a forgiven individual. But when we look at ourselves, that is one of the most difficult things for us to comprehend. Because we know what we've done, and you can only kind of guess what they've done. When we look at what we have done, and then we have to feel that Christ is, because he's with us all the time. You remember how scary that was when you first realized that? Because we know he's been with us all of this time. We do not see him as an entity, as our God who envelops us with his arms and fills us with what it is that we need to make it day by day, as well as his love and grace. Most of us see that as a concept that's very hard to believe. We do not see ourselves as forgiven, and we do not see ourselves as worthy of being forgiven. When we feel badly about ourselves, we go through a strange phenomenon that when someone wants to be close to us, we have a thought process that goes, well, if they want to be close to us, and we don't feel good about ourselves, there must be something wrong with him, therefore I don't want to be close to that person. Have we all had that experience? Okay, those of you who have always had good self-concepts, you won't have any idea what I'm talking about. If you've had moments where you felt like you were not the best person that you could be, then you probably understand part of that process. It's scary to be one with another individual. It's scary to be so close to someone that you could share any amount of pain, any personal pain. It's scary because some people give the message that they are too fragile to handle pain, because they were told in their family of origin that they are too fragile, that they are too fragile to handle pain. So what we do is we divide the family up, just as we saw here in terms of how people handle stress. We also have different family members who will, there seems to be one who's more expressive than anyone else, emotionally expressive. There's one who may cry a lot. Okay? And sometimes that person is seen as breaking down. It's not seen as being an expression of family pain. It's seen as just someone who breaks down. Someone may be the cold, hard person who has to step back and make all the intellectual decisions. No one is comfortable with either one of those roles. And that helps to create this. When we can share those roles, one with the other, that's when the gap begins to close. Because God has already given us everything that we need to be able to close the gap. All we have to do is to draw upon that resource. But that's the scariest part. What do you do if you get as one with someone, especially when you're under a lot of stress, as people are here at the seminary? What do you do when you get, well, what happens? How does stress keep you apart? Let's do that first. How's your relationship different under stress? Yes. Go into a survival mode. Yeah.
And usually that, along with that, then communication begins to break down between the two.
Yeah.
A relationship can almost become a threat to what you need to get done. Go away, don't bother me, I have to get this report written.
Is that an accurate assessment? He said that relationship almost becomes a threat. So that, go away, I've got to get this report done, did I? Yes. 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 Because for some reason there is the myth that when you come in, the wife is supposed to support the husband rather than a mutually supportive arrangement. Now, how that ever developed, I don't know, because most of us are of average intelligence, are we not? Most of us, when we share a burden, we have half a burden. We share that load. When you have to support, and some of you are still supporting your families of origin, for whatever reason. You know, if a mom calls, it's like, oh no, I've got to go fix mom. Okay, so it's like you've got one family that's sitting on one shoulder, your present family sitting on the other shoulder, and you feel kind of wobbly, and you can't figure out why. You feel kind of tired a lot, and I didn't do anything all day, I'm just tired. And my back hurts. My shoulders hurt. My head feels like it's going to explode. And those are signs, physical signs to us that we're dealing with too much. Usually when your stomach hurts, I tend to have more stomach pain, believe it or not. When your stomach hurts, it's like because of all the stuff you had to swallow. When your head hurts, it's because of all the stuff that's in your head that just wants to explode to get out. When your heart hurts, when you have pains around the heart, it's because you're suffering from a terrible sadness. We do have physical symptoms related. In the seminary, whenever you get in any situation with a lot of stress, you have a lot of physical symptoms. But you have a lot of emotional symptoms too. It is those things, survival, God help me get through today, rather than God, you've already given me what I need to get through the day, let me enrich the relationship and the gifts that I have. We can't see it. We can't see it because we're under stress. The more stress we are under, the more we get what's called a tunnel vision. All you can see is your problem, and that's all. Even if your problem is 5% of what you do, all you can see is that problem. That's tunnel vision. And it's easy for me to stand up here and say, well, you need to put that tunnel vision in your pocket. You can't do it. You have to have some help. And the place to get that help is from your spouse, because the spouse is the one who is the closest to you and is in the best position to be a support. If you don't trust your spouse, or if you have a fear of getting too close, it's going to be very difficult for you, for both parties. You know what it's like when someone is avoiding getting close to you? Of course, I joke about thriving on rejection, so I can write books about that. But for the rest of you, do you know what it's like when you pursue someone and they actively pursue getting away from you? First love poem I ever wrote, this girl took it and tore it, and I know, but there's no problem. I can handle it. We need to be able to share. When we ventilate verbally what is going on with us, we dissipate and take the wind, the strength, the power, if you will, out of a lot of the issues that are going on within us. They become more workable. It's like taking that hard lump of clay and then working it. It's like telling someone, when someone close to you has died, the first time you tell someone, that's the hardest time. Second time is almost equally as hard, but the third time it starts getting easier. And there's a reason for that. You start to become desensitized to that. It doesn't mean you care any less. It simply means that you're better able to process the information that you're having to process. Okay, no longer is it just when you say so-and-so has died, does it engulf you and give you that feeling like I just can't stand it, and the tears come. After a while, it's like, I know that I will survive. When you're able to disclose and to share pain, to be intimate with your marital partner or with the one with whom you wish to be married to, your burdens are lightened. And it's a funny thing, your burdens do not add to someone else's burdens. When you share this, it simply lightens your load. Now, there are those of you who come from a family who has told you that if someone tells you something, you are to take that and to worry about it at all costs. It has become not only your burden, but it is to be added in such a way that it makes your own problem seem so much smaller and insignificant, because you're probably small and insignificant, and you have to work so hard to fix everyone else. You're tired a lot and probably not feeling too well either. It's helpful to find someone who can help you get rid of some of that burden. Are there any questions about anything we've talked about here? I'm just rambling. Yes.
Let me ask you about a practical application of what you just said.
Speak just a little louder, please.
Sure. I encountered, as a director of Christian education working with a pastor, a person for whom his philosophy in terms of their marriage relationship was that it was not appropriate for him to take his congregational burdens and share them with his wife, because it put her in a position where she knew more than maybe what she should know, and would therefore be able to say to other members who might say, well, you know what's going on with so-and-so, well, no, I don't know anything about it. I also saw within that couple a real breakdown in communication and some real marital problems as a result of that kind of an approach. I can understand some of the fear about doing so and maybe some cautions about it, but where would you see that kind of a situation fitting in terms of having a healthy marriage relationship, being able to bear one another's burdens in that marriage relationship, and yet keeping it, I don't know, kosher as far as the congregational
there,
and that kind of thing?
I divide this. There are people experts who will take this in all different directions. My personal feeling is that I divide this church dilemmas into two different categories. One are like personal confession tithing, counseling issues, personal issues. The other issues, the church burdens, the same types of things that every other member is discussing at home, I also discuss at home. But my wife has a unique way of, when someone asks her a question, of looking surprised and saying, "What?" And I have always appreciated that about her. On the other hand, every time she goes, "What?" to me, I wonder, you know. No, I'm just kidding. I do share with her. I share these burdens because I am a worrier, and I when I share this, it feels much better. And I know from my own intellectual self as well as my heart that I do much better when I have someone with whom to share my ministry. And I do consider that sharing and support in that ministry. Yes.
In that particular situation, there are certain things that we may feel burdened about that maybe a week later we wish that we didn't share it because maybe now we've tainted our wife's opinion of some people in our congregation. And I wonder, is there also some other kind of group that we have around ourselves that we can share with that would be more, let's say, outside the congregation, would be more objective, more, where they would not be affected by the congregation. This could be Don Joe, and they wouldn't know who it is. But they can, you can release that burden. Can there be an understanding between you and your wife in that way so that you don't cause her to stumble, I guess, that is, into having some tainted observation of a congregational member that's really hurt you for something?
Well, actually, if a congregational member has hurt me, I have to deal with this is not a good, healthy way to do this. But I have to deal with them as a pastor, and I have to just swallow that stuff and look them and smile. If my wife gets angry about that, then I don't really have to. So that's kind of a help. But it doesn't help her. It helps me. And it's not a good, healthy way to be. But pastors don't deal with conflict as a whole, deal well with conflict. Actually, there are support groups from pastors, but those are few, really few and far between. I have a real fear about rescuing my wife or protecting my wife from what's going on within the congregation, because I'm afraid I'll give her the impression that, one, I'm vulnerable, or two, that she's fragile, and I would not imply either one to her. So now I tend to let her have her be her own person, and as long as she doesn't share that with that individual. You know, the first time, see, that would kill that. And my wife never has done that. I tell her, I'm really angry with this person. They said this, it's unfair, et cetera, et cetera. And they go, yeah, it does seem unfair. But the first time she would go back and say something to that individual, that would cut it off. It would never happen again. And that, because that's a rule in my family. And it shouldn't be that way. That's an unforgivable sin in my family, is that if you disclose something I have told you in confidence, forget it. That's the last confidence I will ever share with you. Sad, isn't it? Whew. I need to see a counselor. I do. Yes.
Assuming, and in discussions with professors and the like, I come to the conclusion that we cannot get rid of stress, especially in this place. What kinds of things, and maybe some of this can carry over into the parish and some of us support your students, what kind of things can we as either leaders in our congregations or leaders here on campus, what kind of things can we do about the stress? You know, we talked a little bit about that, but you know, we can't get rid of it, or can we? I remember Sue Nider sharing with the president's council about her life as a seminary and some of the stresses that, you know, their family's experienced, and I'm just starting to get a glimpse of those. You know, if we can't get rid of them, what can we do as an institution, and therefore then next year as a church?
Well, let's go at it from this route, because here I'm a professor very low on the totem pole. When we have stress, when anyone experiences stress, there are only one of three things that one can do. You can either change yourself, you can change the situation, or you can change the way you perceive the situation. Where I'm at, the seminary is a certain way, whether it's right or wrong, good or bad, that, you know, this is the way it is. And so I, if any change comes, it would come very slowly and over a long process. So the quickest way, because I may not live that long, right? I mean, my stomach would be gone from acid. As a student, in particular professors, it's kind of a nice place to be now. You can change yourself in that you can do things differently. You can change your family rules. You can, and by doing that, that means learning to grow closer to your spouse, learning to disclose and to share information, learning to deal with conflict in a more productive way. Or you can change the way you perceive this institution. And that's what I did when I went through the seminary, because the seminary was very stressful for me, and I had a family and kids and a dog and all that. But what I perceived was that this is a means to an end. It was a very unhealthy thing for me to do as I look back, because I did not glean from the seminary what it was that I really needed to glean. I did what I needed to do, and I got out, and I was happy to be out. But in terms of using these resources to enrich or to use the stress to promote growth, I did not do that. And that seems very sad. You cannot grow without some stress. You won't do well on a test without some stress. And the some stress is called eustress because it's a good stress. It's distress that we get into trouble with. And it's because we perceive this external threat, we internalize it, and see it as something dangerous. We do that with each other. That's perhaps the saddest part. Because as far as I'm concerned, the family is the main entity where we gain strength, because I believe that God works through our family, through our relationships, as well as through His Word. I'm not saying the family is a means of grace, heaven forbid. I'm simply saying that God working within each of us, we do lift each other's burdens, and we do promote growth within each other. And when we have that along with the means of grace and the Word, and the friendship and the fellowship that we have here, there can be growth. But we have to perceive it differently. When we have an enemy that we cannot conquer, there is so much stress that we begin to dissolve. We've seen that in Vietnam veterans. We see that in war. If you have a friend, I used to have a guy when I was in 7th grade, he was a 10th grader, he always wanted to beat me up, you know. That was a tremendous, my whole life's like that, and I don't know why. I'm going to have to look into that someday. But when we have an enemy that we cannot conquer, we have stress. When we have an entity that creates some stress, but with which we can work and grow, it's a very different, we change our perception in that way of the institution. And yes, that's easy for you to say, Joe Barber, I know that, but I'm just telling you that it can be that way. But you can't do it by yourself, and I'm convinced of that. You have to have people who support you, either your roommate, your spouse, your family, someone. But they, in turn, have to support you. When your husband is just barely making it, emotionally speaking, and you have no one with whom you can share because one more burden he's going to break, that means that you're loaded up and you have no place for you to go. So you have two people walking around who are ready to break. When you share with one another, you do not add to the other's burden. I'll repeat myself. You simply lighten each other's load. Yes. By stop talking. See, you have to be. Yeah.
For me, that's part of my relief.
Yes, but see, you have to be talkative because he's not. That's part of that balance. If you have a non-talker and the other person doesn't, as a non-talker, nothing's ever said. You know, the stuff that needs to be verbalized is never spoken. So, in therapy, what we would do would be, I would say, well, go through 2 hours and not say anything. That's silence. You'd be surprised what this man's going to tell you. You have to be certain that you want to hear what he has to say, though. Yes.
Could you talk a little bit about changing the roles that we receive from our families, or just, you know, how you go about that? If you can isolate specific things you want to change.
If there are specific things that you want to change, first of all, you have to know certain things. One, that the family is going to not want you to do that. Even if it's something good, you know, they're not going to want you to do that. You're going to have to be able to put some kind of, I don't want to say objective criteria, but some measure by which you can say, this is the way it was, this is the way I want to be, and you'll probably end up someplace in the middle. If you can be happy with just being adequate with that, then you'll be okay. But I would make the changes very small initially and build upon the change rather than say, you know, I'll never smoke again. It's easier to say, I'm going to smoke 2 less cigarettes than I did yesterday kind of thing. Does that help? Okay. Yeah.
Is there any words for what we call those things when we start doing things that our family taught us don't do, and there's little voices that come along and say, what are you doing? And you feel terrible and guilty, and they keep following you and following you years, and it's kind of
Yeah. See, it's the guilt that keeps us trapped and locked in. It's like, and I talk about this in class, the rules are just there. For instance, I told you I grew up in a family with three girls. My rule was I never could figure out why when they finished using the bathroom they did not lift the seat back up. Now see, now we laugh at that, but where is it written? Where is the law that says the seat has to be down at all times? There is no law. You know, 100 years ago, that wasn't even an issue. In some places where my family lived, it's still not an issue. But we see, we develop a certain way of seeing, of perceiving, and we're stuck with that. And there is no other way. When you can open yourselves up to seeing, perhaps as God sees us, and that's one of the easiest ways, because it's very black and white in most instances the way He sees us. When we can see the world differently, we can begin to see ourselves differently, and then we begin to operate differently. When we see our family as a family that perhaps taught us some things that were good and we're blessed with that, but some things that are not working for us, it's easier for us to say things are different now and I need to let that go. Sometimes we use a metaphor, family therapists use a metaphor of cutting something off, literally, and putting it into a bag. You can't throw it away because it's too powerful, but you can put it in the closet and close the door. We also use tapes, the word tapes. These are tapes that were given to you. And when we get into a similar situation as in childhood, we start running the tapes back. And what gets really bad is that we have to change the situation to get the tape to work. So what we do is we literally have people make a tape about rules and regulations that our parents have given us, especially for a parent who is deceased. And we have them take that tape, dig a hole, and bury it. And with it, they bury their parents. And they do a eulogy that says, "Thank you for allowing me to grow up. Thank you for giving me the resources to be what I am. And thank you for the resources to be able to change to be what I want to be." Heavy, isn't it? We can't end on that note. Yes.
Without getting into personal revelation about us, not from God.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly what I want to talk about is God's Word and the power that's in His Word to help us get through stressful situations. We have found that as we have grown spiritually, we have grown closer together. We have come to find out how to handle stress and how to relieve that for each other based on the sure foundation of our faith.
Amen. The problem that some couples face is that the cross seems very far away. And it seems like there's a swamp between ourselves and the cross. It's that part. It's the Word that gets us through that, and it's the friendship and the fellowship that we have that gets us through that, I think. But amen. But yeah, I think you have to be at a certain point where you're able to fully realize what all that God has given. Yeah.
I have a feeling, though, Joe, that what stands in my way in my devotional, spiritual development between my wife and myself, the same thing that stands in the way of my own spiritual development, you know, the intellectualization of everything and the, you know, over academic setting that I have placed myself in, those things keep me away from a profitable devotional spiritual development on my own. The same thing stand in my way, you know, between my wife and I guess I'm just saying that realization has taken a great stride forward.
Yeah.
Simply the realization that's going to be a problem. You know, we haven't solved the problem yet, but simply that realization has simply catapulted us.
To have a mechanism, it's called metacommunication, to talk about how you communicate. To have a meta problem solving to problem solve on how you're going to problem solve is very helpful. Yes.
They talk about an anger therapy, especially to own the feeling. You must own the anger before you can deal with it. How is that? Can you apply that to stress also?
Well, I don't know about owning it. One has to recognize it. Because unlike say it's the kind of thing that Rogers would say, you know, you have an event and then you feel this kind of thing, and that's, you know, a lot of people utilize that. But as far as I'm concerned, the heartstrings are attached. When something's wrong with my little girl, there's something wrong with me. You know, when there's something wrong with my spouse, there's something wrong with me. And she may own the problem, but the fact of the matter is I feel that hurt as well. Our time...
Okay. Please, this is kind of encapsulated.
Okay.
If, of course, we hear some stories of possibly someone in the community that the stress got, you know, however you want to label it, stress got. So along the lines of preventive, that, you know, I would just ask what resources are available here at the seminary for families, and then secondly, how is that viewed according to our future placement, if I say that correct.
The seminary is not only a training institution, it is a screening institution. And that puts us in an immediate double bind. The way it works in practice, and I'll share this, I don't assume that this is a secret, is that if you come to a professor with a dilemma of some kind, if it is the kind of dilemma that has nothing to do with your ordination, you know, like... politely. If you are involved in an activity or a behavior that would prevent you from being a minister, pastor in the truest sense of the word, this is too vague. Let me go the other route. If you present a problem that is a personal issue that has nothing to do with how you would function as a pastor, the seminary works very hard to provide whatever resource it can, whether that means off-campus or on-campus resources, to see that that dilemma is met. Okay, there's no record that's kept. You know, if you come in and say, we're having some marital difficulties, it's based on the stress we're presently experiencing, that is not considered an ordination-threatening kind of deal. It's ordination-threatening if you come in and say, we've decided to get a divorce. Okay, then the seminary they have certain policies that deal with that. If you're engaged in an illegal activity, you know that, you know, there's a policy about that. That's just it. Normally, what happens is that you would see Dean Vogel. He would share with you, you would share with him what you think the dilemma is. He would share with you what he thinks the seminary could do or not do, and you kind of go from there. I would encourage you, Dean Vogel is an excellent man. I have tremendous faith and respect and trust in him because when we work together very well, and the information is confidential. He allows me to work with folks confidentially as long as it doesn't, you know, cross certain boundaries. But I would encourage you, if you have a difficulty, call somebody. Call me. Call Dean Vogel anonymously if you have to, you know. Get some help, because 99% of the stuff that goes on in your life is not as bad as you think it would be. Not that it hurts any less, but in the sense of getting help and being eligible for help and us wanting to help you kind of thing. Does that help at all? Okay. Professor Bricorni has an evaluation that he would like you to fill out and to do. I want to thank you for your participation as he hands this out. And if you would lay these on this back table back here, perhaps. Thank you. Thank you.
Let me do-